stand by. Good day, everyone, and welcome to today's Insta-Care Court Conference. Today's call is being recorded. At this time, I will turn the conference over to Mr. Robert Jagenich. Please go ahead.
Hi, I'm Bob Jagenich. Just to introduce myself a bit, in case any of you don't know me, I've been involved with the medical device field for over 35 years, including diagnostics and medical IT. I was involved with Keith when we formed the company originally as Care Decision back in 1999, and I think where the company is right now, what we started out to be is where I think the country is going and is, so I think it was very fortuitous that the beginning, although we've had a long start, is starting to catch up with us. I've been on the board since 2001, privately I'm working, although I still have some involvement with medical devices, my businesses are getting more involved with advanced biofuels in the Western United States. I'd like to tell you what I'm going to talk about, the highlights of 2009, the impact of healthcare legislation, and strategic development. What we are working on next, what we hope to accomplish, as brief as possible, and we may from time to time have Keith Berman help chime in on the details. Highlights. You may have read the stockholder letter, so some of this is repetitive. Bear with me if you haven't seen it, but we had a great year last year in terms of revenues, $14.7 million, $1.6 million profit. Some of that are one-time gains, but it still was a very good year from a variety of reasons. All that income and revenue came from our home care business, which is growing, and we expect, as it says in the letter, to do nearly $20 million in revenues and $1.6 million in profit next year. That business is expanding, first of all, because there's a growing recognition of our service and combined with unique software support. We've been able to take some of the technology that we have developed for the IT business, the electronic medical records business, to support our supply business, home care supply business, and that has given us, I think, a competitive edge. We've added two new distribution centers. We are expanding our product lines, which not only gives us more to sell, but at a more profitable basis. So it's that business is growing well. The big thing that I think everybody is aware of, it's in the news all the time, is the healthcare legislation. It will have an impact if the legislation goes through, everybody is a pundit on this, so I don't want to comment where we think that's going, but if the legislation does pass, or at least some of it or part of it, we think we'll expand the customer base, and home care will even become more important as a way of reducing cost and allowing it to be available to more people. The electronic medical records business has already been impacted by the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, AAR, or the Obama Stimulus Plan. Doctors are already being paid or reimbursed anywhere from $44,000 to $64,000 per office to having enough electronic medical records. Also, I think there's a trend is that doctors just don't sit in their office all the time. We know that more and more of them are circuit riders. They go to different offices, different clinics all the time. They're in the hospital. They're on the road. They're doing things. And we think our technology that I'm going to talk about is very important. If the pending legislation comes through in different forms we've seen, it could have a major impact on that business that I think is highlighted by Bill Welling and his letter regarding or his forecast is of our potential earnings. Product development. I think the most exciting thing is we've always had a base for doing mobile, for allowing doctors to have mobile access to EMR But now we've expanded that to work on a smartphone. And there's, as everybody is aware of, there's many different brands, and we have a platform that will work on most of the more popular brands that are out there. In addition to that, we've taken, I think, the origins of the company, which was where we got the name Care Decision, which we assist doctors in making a diagnosis. We've developed a unique tools that help doctors in making medical decisions based upon game theory. We are expanding that, so we greatly enhanced our product line. And in regards to the new technology that we brought for, we are in the process of obtaining patents. We have a one-year window that started in November, but we are optimistic that we will be able to secure some intellectual property, secure our intellectual property through the patent process. I think one of the things that the board has decided is that this EMR is so large as a potential market, and we have with our technology that it's going to be difficult to go alone, and there's a lot of big players in it that have different attributes that can be helpful to us that can take our technology and run with it. So we I think a validation of the technology is that we have had six parties, major companies in the healthcare area, contact us rather than we go out and seek them, which I think is a validation of the technology.
And Bob, a seventh one this morning.
A seventh one. Very good. I didn't know that. There we go. Our contactiness because, well, many of these people have certain aspects of the technology that's really based upon having a fixed EMR system in a hospital or a clinic or a doctor's office. Nobody has the mobile type of product that we've developed. And so we're seeking strategic partners. I think strategic partners that have marketing muscle, that have the ability to reach out to the healthcare industry, and companies also that see our product as filling holes in their product line, I think are both interested in us and would be natural partners for where we're going. So we hope to have serious discussions at least by this quarter with at least two of them, or narrow down our selection process, and that hopefully by the end of the year we'll be in full operations with them. So that's basically where we are on the EMR. The last thing is that we think that because of the company's successes in the last year, we are actively seeking an Amex listing. The goal is to qualify this year. If we do, and when we do, the advantage will be we'll have a greater trading exposure. We'll be allowed to more brokerage offices, and I think we will start to attract institutional investors, which will also help, I think, the stock and help the company's view in the world. So that's kind of the summary of what I'd like to say. Bill, are you ready to follow on?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Bill, why don't you introduce yourself?
I'm Bill Walling. I'm a chartered financial analyst. I've had about 50 years of experience in Wall Street and various activities, starting out as investment analyst, later moving to portfolio management, later director of research, and after that investment strategist. And I've been engaged to the company to participate in this financial guidance matter. Before I get going on that, I just wanted to say that I thought this shareholders letter that was sent by the board over Bob's signature, that's going to be a tough act to follow. That's the best shareholder letter from a small company I've seen in my half century as an analyst, and I actually prepared several myself. I wish I could say I had prepared this one. The reason that I'm giving it such plaudits is that it's comprehensive. There's nothing that I know of that wasn't mentioned in greater or lesser detail. It's specific in regarding the actual context. The syntax is very well written, so it's clear, and I commend it to careful review by anybody that's seriously interested in this company. Well, my role here is to assist in the financial guidance aspect of matters, And I think the best way to do that is just to read the five or six sentences that represent the introduction in my letter to the board on January 25th, and it's, quote, you have engaged me to, one, work with you in the published 2010-2011 financial guidance for shareholders and other interested parties. Two, to participate in your guidance conference call scheduled for January 27th. And three, prepare an investment research report about ISCR at a later date. This memo was solely concerned with the financial guidance matter. In effect, you have retained me to be the surrogate for your shareholders regarding financial guidance about ISCR during 2010 and 11. I'm pleased to have the opportunity to work with you in this capacity on their behalf. This protocol emphasizes how seriously you regard the subject of comprehensive and straightforward communication with your shareholders about your company's near and intermediate term issues and plans. I think your decision to retain an experienced external financial analyst to evaluate management's guidance forecast has much merit, and that other publicly traded companies should consider adopting this practice. So that said, let me get into my evaluation. First, what are the forecasts? And I assume that you have this on your screen or printout or have seen it, but let me just run through the numbers quickly here. The revenues in 2007, and I'm going to round to roughly the nearest million-dollar number here. In 2007, revenues were a mere $6 million. In 2008, they rose sharply to $15 million. And by the way, 2008 was the worst economic year in the economy since the Great Depression. And this company came through smoking in that time frame. 2009, based on the annualized three-quarters results, it looks like revenues are going to come pretty close to $20 million. So, the bottom line there is that in 2 years, from 2007 through 2009, revenues more than tripled. So something's going on in the demand forces. Now, picking up from there, management made the forecast for 2010 and 2011 under two different scenarios. The first was without health care reform, that is to say, the things as they are and go forward from there. And the management forecast was for revenues to reach $30 million this year, up from $20 million last year, and to advance further to $45 million in 2011 relative to the $30 million forecast for this year and again back to the $20 million for last year. The second scenario was with health care reform, and it was assumed that health care reform would fatten these numbers a bit, and as a result, 2000 revenues would reach $32 million instead of $30 million, and revenues in 2011 would reach $52 million instead of $45 million. So what we're talking about here is revenues going from $6 million in 2007 and to 2011 on an estimated basis, reaching somewhere pretty close to the $50 million area. Well, that's an eightfold increase. So that is well worth knowing. Now, how does this happen? Well, I can't help but remember that some guy named Newton about 300 years ago said that a body in motion tends to stay in motion. And I suspect that some of you who are on this conference call here may employ a momentum trading philosophy with respect to your own trading patterns. I'm not saying that's the only way to do things, but there is a lot to be said for this. Once something's moving, it tends to keep moving. Now, there are limits on that and so on. But what is going on here, I think, is to recognize that there are powerful underlying forces that have been at work and continue to be at work, even without the new products coming online. As far as I'm concerned, my experience is that one way to test the reasonableness of a forecast, in this case, the 30, 50 million numbers here that management has presented, and to test it by assuming a different set of extreme conditions. Let's assume that revenues had gone from, did go from 6 million to 20 million in 09. Suppose management had presented a forecast and said, well, no further growth. We're just going to stay at 20 million. I frankly would find that extremely dubious. How is it that revenues could triple, more than triple in 2 years and then suddenly flat? So I would consider that to be very skeptical. I would really be asking many, many questions. What's happening here? We're not selling automobiles. You're not selling houses with durable goods that have machinery that has long lives. Far from it. In fact, the exact opposite. Take the other case. Suppose that management had said, well, revenues are $20 million in 2009, and we think they're going to be $100 million in 2011. Well, I would have raised many eyebrows there. So wait a minute. How does this go up fivefold in 2 years? I know you got a new product, but I think that's asking too much of the product. Well, as it turns out, as we've noted, forecasts actually come in the middle here, in this 50 million-ish area. And the reason that revenues have been growing nicely, and I think are likely to, there's several key reasons. First, there's a very powerful demographic trend that's at work here. Our society is aging. We've got a little over 300 million people. The average age has been creeping up. Now it's 77 years old. And for the average person, 80% of their lifetime medical outlays will occur after age 55. And you think about it intuitively, and says, sure, you know, a lot of older people, and it's one infirmity after another. So if you're in the healthcare business, this graying process provides a tailwind of demand growth. 40% of prescriptions, Rx prescriptions, are filled for patients over 55. Well, that makes sense, too. So that broad secular trend is under, long-term trend is underway. Now, as far as the historic product that Bob's cited here, the diabetes and medical surgery products, there's enough oomph in those product line demands, that determinants themselves, to drive revenues up 140% in 2008 when the economy declined 6%. So it's important to understand that the existing product line and the historic product line has some built-in growth characteristics itself. These products, in one form or another, mainly some disposable, so demand is recurring. They're somewhat recession resistant. So that's how revenues tripled. And that's a big a mouthful between 07 and 09. Now, we believe that there's a new high-quality technological product coming on here, the software functionality into these smartphones. This is going to aid and abet electronic record management keeping within the administrative side of the $2 billion that's spent on healthcare in this country. A huge chunk of that's in the administrative side. This can help. It has the additional advantage, as Bob mentioned, the circuit rider, our doctor, so to speak. You got point of service entry into the device and therefore into the computer base itself. There, by the way, there's no direct competitor in the market with this at the present time. And significantly, only a minority percentage of physicians are now using electronic record management for all of the record keeping. So there's a major opportunity for an effective device to make penetration here. And Bob's letter, on behalf of the board, has referred to this MD at hand, MD practice probe, MD at work, those particular subdivisions of the product suite, referred to them as being, quote, crown jewel, quote, referring them as the future of Instacare. And there must be some exciting prospects here because the company has publicly acknowledged that six large other corporate entities are expressing interest in talking. So there's societal graying on the macro side. There's, at the micro level, there's a dynamic new digital product at the company. So that's why I think those revenue forecasts are highly defensible. And I've signed off on them accordingly, as you can see. Now, what about the earnings side of things? Well, what the company has used here is EBITDA. That's not only an abbreviation, it's an accounting acronym. And technically, just so we know what we're talking about, the E stands for earnings, the B means before, I stands for interest, T is for taxes, and the D and the A stand for depreciation and amortization. Well, in the case of Instacare, at this point in time, only a small amount of expenses are incurred for interest. The company now, presently, and for going forward, will have no federal taxes to pay because of the NOL. So the T doesn't count in this equation, and the depreciation and amortization is really minimus. So what it boils down to is that EBITDA, which might look a little bit foreboding, really becomes a virtual synonym for earnings. So let's go to the videotape and see how these earnings have moved over the past several years. Again, let's use 07 as a base year. EBITDA, earnings, was a minus 1.1 million. That's a little scary. 2008, with the big surge in revenues, EBITDA turns positive at 0.5. That's 500,000, half a million. That's a swing plus 1.6 million. Okay. 2009, looks to me, well, the forecast has been somewhere in the area of 2 million, for the EBITDA. That does include a large one-time gain. Now, the forecasts going forward call for EBITDA to be $2 million again in 2010, but that's still a good number because it will not have that large one-time debt extinguishment gain in it, which I think was $1.3 million. And the forecast is for EBITDA rising to $8 million in 2011. Under the with health care reform, that should enrich in numbers here, and it looks like $2.2 million for 2010, $9.2 million for 2011. So what we're looking at here, let's take the 2009 as the base. And we're looking at EBITDA there, earnings, $2 million. In the 2011 time frame, with no health care reform, $8 million, with health care reform, $9 million, let's just cup it and say we're roughly talking about EBITDA going here from $2 million to $9 million. Well, how is this possible? What it boils down to is this. We're assuming that the top line revenues are going to grow from $20 million to $50 million-ish. So that's a plus $30 million coming in revenues. Query, are costs going to grow at the same pace? They certainly should not, because there's some fixity of cost in here, so that a larger percentage of the incremental revenues, being $30 million, should be coming down to the bottom line. And the EBITDA forecast here are calling for going from $2 million to roughly about $8.5 million. So that's a four-fold gain. So the combination of earnings leverage in the income statement owing to some fixity of costs and, very importantly, much higher projected profit margins on the new MD product line. That is why EBITDA can grow at a significantly faster rate than revenues. And these forecasts between 2009 and 2011 are basically calling for revenues to increase 150% in 2 years, EBITDA to increase something in the area of 350%, and the disproportionality there is caused by the leverage and the assumption of higher product lines and the new products. So the bottom line at my end, why do I believe management's forecasts are reasonable? The revenues grow sharply in the macro level because of this graying of the population. They're projected to grow rapidly because of a microelement, namely the new dynamic technological digital product. And the EBITDA should grow even more sharply than revenues because of the leverage and the higher profit margins. And that's my evaluation of these forecasts. Thank you.
This is Keith, and I'll chime in. I won't take a lot of people's time because very much has been said this morning. Maybe I'll be able to preempt a few of the questions, but I only have three topics that I'm going to cover before we open it up to questions. And my topics are discussion of the patents and the patent filings, discussion of the Amex listing, and discussion of the partnerships, the strategic partnerships that we're currently working on. Bob Jagenich provided a great 10,000-foot helicopter view of things, which I think accurately depicted the direction of the company. Bob and I have worked together a large number of years, 30 years. That's probably longer than some of the people listening here have been born, but we've worked together for 30 years, and Bob's always had the helicopter view, and I've always been the detail guy. So to start, let me talk about the patent process, because I know it interests people. The company is in the process of filing three patents. One is a process patent, and two are product patents. The product patents are for the MD at hand / MD at work with the games theory algorithm built in. And the other is for the MD at practice probe, which is a data mining tool, both of which are somewhat revolutionary products. Before I talk about the patents, let me tell you why we differ so much and kind of like an evolution of the industry, which has been around since 1995, at least we've been involved in it since 1995, at other companies, and we've had our names on other patents and things of that nature. But The issue is that there are basically 600,000 or so physicians that could make use of a product of this nature. These are physicians that see patients on a daily basis. It's about 82-83% of the total physicians in the country. It does include some dentists that perform surgery, and it includes ophthalmologists and things of that nature. Any doctor that is in the need of up-to-the-minute information on a patient that they are seeing is part of the population that we're addressing. The problem in the doctor's office is, for years, has been twofold. The first is that there are geography issues. The business administration of a physician's office is up front, where the patient comes in and says, "I have an appointment," and he meets somebody associated with the doctor to verify the appointment. And the second part of the physician's practice is the examining room or rooms where the physician actually interacts with the patient. The business equipment in a physician's office is up front. The need for the business equipment, in this case, the clinical equipment, is in the examining room. And nobody has ever really been able to overcome that problem without wiring a physician's office for terminals and computers and the like in every examining room. The majority of physicians, over 90% of them, do not have this wired practice, if you will. So companies like us and other companies have tried to approach that market from a number of standpoints. Our first generation product was based on a desktop computer that connected to the internet. If you looked at it today, it kind of looked archaic, but from the company standpoint, it was pretty much at that point the only product on the market, with the exception of kind of another well-known company at that point called Healthion, these days known as WebMD. So it was like the two of us duking it out for the hearts and minds of physicians, and we all lost because of a geographical issue. Physicians would not leave the examining room to walk 20, 30 feet to the front of the office to get information on the patient. No matter how much insurance companies were willing to subsidize that process. Then the market moved into PDAs. And why? Because a PDA could be carried in the doctor's pocket and they could have access to the PDA. The problem with the PDA was the doctor had a cell phone and a stethoscope in his right pocket and a PDA in his left pocket, and he just didn't want that. So whereas the PDA-based products were neat and they performed wonderful things and they were able to connect to the internet and the technological issues and barriers were overcome, very few doctors used them. And then along came these smart telephones, which are really PDAs that have 100% of the time connection to the internet. And that just changed everything. The difference between where we are today and where we were a year ago is dramatic. The iPhone was just starting. There were no competitors to the iPhone. Some of the Windows phones and the Blackberries were more set up to handle email than they were to browse the net. All of that has changed, and which has led us to the fact that we're first to market. That's a big deal. Being first to market in healthcare is, you know, as Bill Lyons can attest to, it's probably the biggest thing that we have going for us here. And the other issue is that we own our technology. We didn't buy it from anybody. We don't make use of a browser that doctors can push a button here and a button there and connect to somebody else's computer and do this and that. Everything that we do basically puts a mainframe computer in the hand of the doctor. And we're going to file 3 patents on that. And the patent process is as follows. You file the patent. Within 21 days, you get your patent number, and you get the formal listing name of your patent, whatever your invention is called, and who the inventors are. And then for the next 12 months or so, both sides of the process, the patent office and us, prepare to defend our patent to one another. It's called prosecution. Similar to what they call in a criminal case, the company will prosecute its patents with a patent office. About 13 months into the process, the patent office will come back with whatever issues that they have with the patent. And the issues typically are, please explain how your invention is not the same invention as so-and-so's invention filed in 1963 and so on. And there'll be 7 or 8 of those. And we have 90 days to 120 days to answer that, although you really have as long as you want to answer it. But after 120 days, ultimately, if you don't amend your patent application, at that point, the patent office will publish your application, and then you will be in a process where shortly thereafter they will either deny it because you haven't answered them, or you will successfully litigate it or prosecute it to the point of approval. We have very, very strong patents that we are going to file. And one of the things that will happen is the moment we file the patent, the moment we get our listing number, that's the day that anybody else that wants to get into the industry, into the business using similar technology is going to have to start driving around the things that we did. And that's a big deal. So I'll leave the rest of the discussion of any patents to discussion, question and answer, and I want to move on to Amex. The Amex listing is a listing that we covet for a number of reasons. Number one, we meet their criteria for the type of company that they're looking for. They're looking for small, high-tech companies with a revenue stream and 2 years of profit poised to make huge gains in terms of market capitalization. And those gains can come from a number of sources. You can raise additional capital. Your stock can appreciate. You can make acquisitions and things of that nature. The typical growth over a 2-year period after an Amex listing is about 10 times market valuation. So if we have a market valuation of $10 million, an Amex listing is probably good if we handle it right. Don't over-dilute and things of that nature. It's probably good for a 10 times market cap valuation. Healthcare companies, particularly healthcare companies in the middle of government legislation, probably will do slightly better than that, maybe much better than that. We want to move on to Amex because we fit their criteria. We meet most of their listing criteria. We're going for the 25 million market cap. We have enough shareholders. The value of the float is probably not where Amex is looking for, and our current stock price isn't $3. But they will negotiate the $3 stock price. I've done a search and research on this, and we've also talked to several brokerages in New York that desperately want us to hire them to move us into the Amex range, maybe make an acquisition through them and that sort of thing. We're basically looking at perhaps getting the stock to $1.50, $1.75, and then we'll be looked at very seriously. If we get to $1.50, $1.75, the other problem takes care of itself, which is the market cap. We immediately meet the upper end of the market cap and should go on to Amex. We have a clean filing history. We file audited financials and have for the last 9 years. I know that's a question that's come up in the past. We're a bulletin board company, yes, but we are a fully reporting company, and you can look at our long history of filing with the SEC, and we follow those rules, and when we file our 10-K, it is with audited financials from an SEC-approved auditor. Last thing is partnerships. The company is reaching a fork in the road, and as Yogi Bear once said, when you reach a fork, you take it. That's pretty much where we're at. On the left fork, we have companies, various types of companies that are interested in working with us, commercial laboratories, for their business reasons, the ability to move information out of the commercial lab and into the doctor's hands seamlessly. Insurance companies, we would be both a cost center and a revenue center for an insurance company, because one of the problems that companies face when they deal with insurers is the doctors face when they deal with insurers is what has been done to this patient by other doctors, by other clinics, and so on. So insurers are very interested in this. We've been contacted by two or three. We will probably choose two or three to contact ourselves based upon our knowledge of how our product would fit with their corporate culture. And then finally, we've been contacted by some legacy systems vendors. And these are typically larger, older companies with large hospital or doctor client bases that have a hole in their product line, hole as in H-O-L-E, a hole in their product line where they cannot provide information to the doctors that they call their clients without the doctor going out and buying another large $50,000 to $100,000 system. So we view this as very positive. The alternative is we have a lot of experience in doing this ourselves. My view and Bob's view is that we should probably visit these partnerships first, although they will slightly limit the market we can sell into. They will provide both people resources, monetary resources, and the ability to get the product out there quickly. It is our belief, the board's belief, that all of the promise that the Hospitalist Corporation showed in this company dating back to 1999 when they first hired us and paid us big bucks to develop the product before we then turned around and bought it back, we believe that all that promise can now be made available to the marketplace. And with that, I'm out of words. So I guess, Bob, are we ready to do a question and answer?
I think so. Bill, do you have anything else to contribute after this?
No, not at this point.
Okay, let's go.
Thank you very much. If you would like to ask a question today, you can do so by pressing *1 on your telephone keypad. Once again, that is *1 to ask a question. A voice prompt on your phone line will indicate when your line is open. We'll pause one moment as we await responses. And as a reminder, *1 on your telephone keypad. We have a first response. Don Barney.
Hey, Don. Hi, guys. Keith, you already know me. I don't know if the other fellas know who I am. One of the questions I had in taking a few notes, when you go to Amex, when do you think, what's your timeline looking at that?
Bob, let me address that.
Sure.
One of the requirements of Amex, in fact, one that they won't deviate from unless the company has a $75 million market cap, is that you have to be profitable for 2 years.
Right, which you are.
Well, which we will be once our 2009 financials are audited.
Got it.
So we have just started the audit process. It's a nuts and bolts process that begins typically with a management discussion with the auditor or the auditing company in mid-January, and the whole process of this is to be complete with the audit about the 10th of March, which would be the 10th of March 2010, and then you draft the 10K, and then the 10K is filed by the 31st of March. The SEC, because of Sarbanes-Oxley, has 30 days upon which to comment on your 10K. In the past, we've been anything but our accounting isn't controversial. The company isn't controversial in terms of the claims that we make and things of that nature. So our belief is that we will be in a position to file for Amex about the 1st of May.
To do so, though, don't you need to be above a dollar?
Yes.
To do so,
you need to be above $3, but that is one of the requirements that they will waive.
Oh, okay. So they will waive the $3, but do you need to be above a dollar, or will they accept you as you are?
We will need to be above a dollar.
Got it. All right. I have a couple other notes, but I'll defer for a moment and let somebody else have a question.
As a reminder, star 1 to ask a question, and we have our next.
My name is Matt Haskell, and I'm an investor, and I'm just curious as to, I'm involved in some companies, especially one in particular, that has to do with filing of patents. And the patents that you're filing, I believe you file a provisional patent, and then you follow that up with a utility patent. Is this the same sort of process?
Yes. The difference is that our provisional patent will be the utility patent.
So you go straight to it?
We're going to go straight to it. Yeah.
Got it.
We sat and talked to the patent counsel, and you gain nothing in the time period other than a quicker number, but we're all set to go with the main filing.
Yeah, the company that I'm involved is a biotech, and it's a lot more complex as far as that's why they want to at least get some protection in before they actually file the utility, which takes a lot longer to put together.
Yeah, biotech and generic drugs are two areas that are handled a little bit differently than the device patent type of process that we're going through.
Okay. One other minor suggestion that I would make to you guys is when you do your press releases, that you don't release them in all caps and the heading is like 5 paragraphs. It seems as though every time I see one of these things, people get very suspicious when they see, you know, all cap press releases. I know it's sort of a graphic design thing, but it really does sort of make you go, well, why do we have to highlight the whole almost the whole text of the press release in the heading. So I would just make that suggestion to you.
And we appreciate that. I don't know if listeners know this, stockholders know this, but we employ a professional to do this. And this gentleman actually is the internal person at a medical IT company who does freelance work at night. He considers the all caps to be kind of like his monogram, but
okay.
Yeah, we'll deal with them.
Just curious.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Once again, as a reminder, star 1 if you would like to ask a question today. And next we'll hear from EJ Rice.
Hey, EJ.
Yes, obviously you've already announced my name. My question was regarding the game theory. Now, the game theory program itself, is that a theory, or has all of the algorithms and variables in the theory already been developed into the software, and this is a battle-tested or minimal-tested program, or this is something that actually exists? Could you elaborate on this game theory design, if you would, please?
Yes. Basically, I'll explain that. You know, Bob Jagenich is an engineer, so he can help me out here. I designed it into the product, and it kind of works like this. What game theory means is it provides a series of decision trees and outcomes based on a series of inputs, okay? And it provides not just pragmatic outputs, but it assigns priorities and percentage outcome and things of that nature to it. One of the problems that a device like this presents is that a lot of times the doctor with the device in their hand does not have a distinct knowledge of the patient or the patient's condition. In HMO settings, that is almost always true. And in a lot of settings where emergency medicine, for example, it's true as well. What the game theory algorithm does. And we actually designed it for the original product in 2000 and 2001. And then a major paper came out in 2004, which kind of validated all of this. What it does is it allows multiple doctor inputs, multiple professional inputs, to provide the doctor with the cell phone in their hand and a series of expected outcomes based upon paths of medicine that they take. And this is really revolutionary. And it will be a major part of our patent application because it is an algorithm.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
Yeah, I'd just like to say that decision support, which is what this company was based upon, is now coming into vogue, and we're really ahead on that curve.
And next we'll take a question from Craig Dervaloy.
Yeah, this is Craig Dervaloy. My quick question is you going to reach a stock price of over a dollar by May period or so? There's basically the two fastest ways to get there is reverse split or reverse merger. And kind of was wondering which way the company was heading. I don't think revenues alone will get you to a dollar based on what you were told us this morning. And that was my question.
Well, can I address the reverse merger part, and then the other guys chime in. One of the avenues to a larger exchange that has been stopped is merging into another vehicle, another public vehicle, and having the same capital structure but making it look different on a balance sheet. That is no longer an approved way to get onto an exchange. And the reason is your new entity didn't make a profit for 2 years. So a reverse merger is certainly not a way that we're considering going on to the exchange. Anybody want to deal with the stock price issue?
We're going to examine all. We're going to take a look at where the stock is in that time frame. See how far that takes us, given all the things that are going on, and a reverse split is not currently being contemplated, but it could be one of the options.
The reverse split would be the last option. I want to say I received calls this morning from three or four investment groups, funds, brokerages that are probably on this call and don't wish to identify themselves, and I'm certainly not going to out you, but there's a substantial interest in accomplishing this with the help of the company. And it could be something to the effect of doing a public offering, a real public offering sponsored by a brokerage or something of that nature. But frankly, Bob Jagenich, Bill Lyons, and I all worked at or for a company in the late 90s where they got their ducks lined up. They decided which funds were going to go in and buy the shares based upon interest in the company. They allowed them to start that. Brokerages became involved. And even before they decided to go on to Amex, the stock went from Bill Lyons, where was the stock? I mean, it was like nowhere, right? 7 cents, something like that?
7 cents is correct.
Yeah. It went from 7 cents to over a dollar in a span of 30 days. And all because the company received interest from people, brokerages, that thought that the company had great potential. And these brokerages are not your usual funds that do equity lines of credit and convertibles and things of that nature. These are real organizations that say, we need $20 million to make this product a huge success because ultimately we can sell this company for $400 million or something of that nature. And that's the route that we wish to take. And we're headed in the right direction. There seems to be a ton of interest. from large companies, and with large companies, particularly the public ones, you get institutional interest. And when you get institutional interest, even where we are down here, you get special situation interest. So from our standpoint, we believe that if we do our job, the stock will take care of itself. And the other goal is we don't want to do a reverse, because if you do a reverse, you end up above a dollar. You probably get your listing, but you've upset a whole bunch of shareholders, and the end result is you get a delisting notice 90 days later because you drop below a dollar. And that isn't our plan.
I'm really glad to hear that. I know as a newer investor to your company, it's frankly because of the long record of audited financials that made me invest in the first part anyway. I think your company's got a lot of promise in, and we really would look forward to the latest share structure as soon as y'all can get that out too. And thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for the question.
And our next question will come from Roger Barnes.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Yeah, I believe it was the guidance you mentioned, one of your main distractions could be problems from previous employers, and I was wondering if you could elaborate on that a little.
Bill Walling, you wrote that. Could you read for me and for Bob Jagenich and Bill Lyons the risk factor that you wrote into your report?
Of course. And it's point number two, management distractions, I'm quoting from my January 25th document. Current management may have to deal with some adverse consequences caused by actions of a former senior officer and directors. If this occurs, it could distract management's focus and impede its efforts to promptly exploit ISCR's attractive product opportunities, and could entail other costs as well, end of quote.
And Bob Jagenich, could you please address that?
Well, this company is obviously a growing company. I mean, these are the type of things you should be aware of. But we've had a history of change that occurred 2 or 3 years ago, and there's always that potential. Although there's nothing in the works right now that looks particularly impending. But you know, anything's possible when you've had such a rapid rise in stock price. Things are going to come out of the woodwork. They just do. And it could be a distraction, although you know, we've gotten good at handling distractions and moving forward, so there's nothing contemplated. It's going to make a big difference.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for the question.
Any other questions?
And currently there are no questions in the queue.
Okay.
Okay. Well, we want to thank everybody for joining us. Bob, do you have any last words? Bill Walling, do you have any last words?
No, I don't. I think the questions were insightful, and I appreciated the responses that were given by management.
Yeah, one last thing. I'd like to welcome Bill Lyons. He's been involved with this company off and on for the last 10 years or so. It's nice to have him back. I think he brings a lot of another perspective that I think we need on the board, and we're hoping to even grow that perspective more in the next coming year. But Bill is a great start to do that. Keith and I have personally helped things together, but it was never our intention to be a two-man board, and this is a great first step.
Thank you, Bob. I appreciate it. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, no other questions, and I guess then we want to thank everybody for attending today, taking time out of their day. I know we have a lot of people that trade stocks for a living, and I know we took part of their trading day away from them. We hope we educated you and gave you an idea of what it's like to to be Instacare, to work at Instacare. I think perhaps we, the next time we get together, we'll do a quarterly earnings release quick conference call because this one went so well and we've enjoyed, at least I've enjoyed it. Bob, you?
Sure.
Bill? Bill?
I certainly have. And I've learned a lot, too.
Anyway, thank you very much.
Very good.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And that does conclude our conference call. Thank you for your participation.